What's happening, weirdos? This is the return of Jimmy Carr, who I'm so excited to have him in the studio for the first time. He did a live episode a few years back in Montreal with me and the Sklar brothers, which was awesome. He's hilarious. But this is the real deal, I think. One-on-one, me and Jimmy. He's so thoughtful. He's so interesting. He's so funny, obviously. And Jimmy has a new Netflix special. He's returning to Netflix with his latest stand-up special, Jimmy Carr, Natural Born Killer, out now. We talk a little bit about it. No spoilers, but obviously I tell him how much I loved it. And Jimmy's brand new international tour, Jimmy Carr Laughs Funny. Laughs Funny. It's on sale now. For tickets and info, visit jimmycarr.com. That's Carr with two R's. JimmyCarr.com for more. Check out his special on Netflix and go see him live. I mean, come on. I'm also really, really happy to say the shows in Florida this weekend went amazing. I want to thank all the weirdos that came out to support me in Dania, I think I'm saying it right now. Dania, Florida. I loved it. A special shout out to Jules and Maria, the two super weirdos that I met after the show. Such sweethearts, and I was so happy to spend some time with them. All right, let's get to it. PeteHolmes.com for tickets. We're adding another show to Chicago. Second show on Thursday, because all the other ones sold out, which is awesome. And all the tour dates are on PeteHolmes.com. In fact, I think I have some new ones that are hopefully up here. Yeah, we have Los Angeles on May 4th, Chicago, Houston, Homestead, Pennsylvania, and Brookfield, Wisconsin at the Milwaukee Improv. So all of those have been announced, PeteHolmes.com. In the meantime, enjoy this chat with the wonderful Jimmy Carr, Natural Born Killer, out now on Netflix. Everybody, get into it. That's what Jimmy's used to.
Yes, as that's actually part of my rider. People might think
you clap just for sync. Yeah. But actually, that's a huge part of my process.
Is walking in when people are syncing microphones.
I will have a...
man, I can help you. Right here. I'm not going to get it, but right there you have a little book of tree stuff. The stuff of trees,
Why
Jimmy.
Wouldn't you get it? Is it not your pay grade? What's your problem?
I didn't want to freak you out. That's what it was.
How freaked out can I be?
Honestly,
oh my God.
I would have...
This is nice. Very nice to see you.
It's so nice to see you. I admire you so much.
Oh, stop it. Stop it. All I really... Have we started?
Yes.
This is it. Okay. All I want to talk about is comedy sex god.
No.
It's all I want to discuss.
Is that real?
Yeah, because I knew it was coming on, so I read it, and it's
you
a phenomenal...
Free.
It's a phenomenal piece of work.
It is not.
It's a really, really great book. I've been quoting you up and down town. That line from AC/DC's Road Manager.
Yeah, Barry Taylor.
Barry Taylor. Give us the line again.
God is the name of the mystery. God is the name of the blanket we put over the mystery to give it a shape.
It blew my mind.
It's such a wonderful...
Because there's two kinds of idiots, right?
Tell me.
There's people that believe in the fairy stories, and there's people that say there's no point in any of this. It's a waste of time.
Yes. There's
a middle way of kind of going, there's something to be had.
Yes,
here.
I am.
AC/DC's Road Manager.
Well, do you know I do it? You certainly don't have to. My latest special, I do it on stage.
That part
of the book was so important to me. Oh, thank you.
I loved it.
I brought it on stage because I was like, that's my whole thing. Is I just want people to hear that quote.
No, the other bit that really you really got into my head with was the bit about going, well, I believe when I die, I go back to God, and you believe in nothing. You believe you go back to nothing.
Nothing.
I think we might be talking about the same thing.
That's exactly right.
It's really interesting. Kind of, I forget what the faith is, but the one that kind of worships all the faiths, you kind of go, there's something in this.
Yeah, sort of a, what do they call it? The perennial wisdom, sort of like everybody's pointing to the same thing.
Yeah.
More or less. And honestly, I'm real into this stuff. And my wife will tell you that, joke here, my wife will tell... At ease. Sure. I actually realized I was like...
His wife's... His wife. The creepy bit is this will be watched back because the wife's clearly buried in the garden. Clearly. Oh, my wife will tell you.
Jimmy.
I can operate her head from above.
I realized we were having a sincere conversation. I was like, you don't have to poke him and make him into... You know what I mean? We can relax. I regret doing that. And... I forget what I was saying, but my wife, what did I say? My wife will tell you that we don't know.
We don't know. I don't know what she'll say.
It doesn't matter. But that stuff is the most important stuff in the world to me, and I study it very... Oh, she'll tell you that nothing excites me more, for real, than when I find teachers from different traditions saying the exact same thing. And I know that sounds like an exaggeration, but when I'm reading somebody from the non-dual understanding or somebody from the even mystical Catholic or whatever it is, and they say something and I'm like, but that's from this, and they don't even know that they're quoting one another, it makes me filled with joy. Just kind of like I am right now, that you yeah. read and enjoyed my book.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. It's a great story as well. It's a great kind of... Because it strikes me that with Crashing, it's the first bit of the book.
Yeah.
It's like the divorce and the comedy and New York and stuff. And I love that show because it struck me as a very authentic, realistic view of a very glamorous bit of the world for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might not have felt glamorous when you were sleeping on people's couches.
Yeah.
Or starting off and flying in New York.
I know what you mean, though.
But coming from the UK and kind of the American stand-up scene always looked so kind of great. And it's an American medium, right?
Yeah.
It's like the Western jazz stand-up comedy.
Yes.
The great gifts America's given the world.
Yes. I completely agree. The word I would use is romantic. So obviously not sexually romantic.
Yeah,
but
no, I get it.
There's a romance to like. No. And when we shot it, on the corner that I really handed out flyers. And when we were back there, still when I walk by, it's 3rd and McDougal, I walk by, I'm like starstruck by a corner. And that I got, this is all hindsight. I wish I had nostalgia for the present. And I did have a little, even while I was doing it, I was like, I can't believe I'm gonna go up in Manhattan tonight. But now I look back and I'm like, do you have that too? I mean, like...
No. I think that for me, that would be the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Yeah, the origin
story. And the trenches
story.
And the guys that you came up with.
Yeah.
And kind of where everyone ended up. It feels like kind of the end of a war movie. Now, if this guy made it, this guy didn't make it. You know, whatever that is for you, it feels like the where are they now kind of thing.
I'm so with you. And I think about, they don't know, the people that I started with that aren't doing it anymore, with full respect, but they stopped. I know their acts. And I think about them, and they're still making me laugh. And there's something really kind of like, I don't know, I hope that's sweet to them.
It's lovely. I don't know if there's any legacy in comedy. My theory is it all goes back in the pot. It's like, well, you know, because people go, who was I chatting about yesterday? Don Rickles, right? I was in Vegas, and I was chatting about Don Rickles, and these guys didn't know who Don Rickles was. Yeah. And you kind of go, okay, well, that doesn't matter because Jeff Ross exists.
Yeah.
And Jeff has... taken some essence of Don Rickles, and he now does that thing, and it's like, okay, well, that's great too. That works.
Don threw the stone in the lake, and the ripples continue, even if you don't remember the stone, which is kind of sad. Obviously, there's a mourning to that. Would like
I
to.
I mean, I kind of think that I like that thing of you die twice.
The day they forget you.
Yeah, the last time someone says your name.
Yeah.
It's nice. It's a nice thing of like, I always think when someone tells you about grief or whatever, you go, well, what was their name? It's a nice remembrance.
Yeah.
Just a little thing, but it's
our
nice.
Our dog just died. And
oh, really?
My 5.5-year-old daughter, I think we're getting a new dog today. Question mark? I think that's where my wife might be.
I didn't
be.
Bring a dog. Now I feel like a dick.
Here,
I didn't know I had to bring a dog.
You'll like this, Jimmy, because I think you'll like this. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I don't like the fact your dog died.
No, I know. And we'll get to that.
I also... You can see that dog there, yeah?
Yeah, that's Katie's dog.
Okay. Because I was about to say, that dog doesn't know it's about to die. Oh, no, we're taping this now, but that dog's not going to make it. Like, there's a dog in the room.
That's not my dog. I am obsessed.
You can see her too, right? No, I just want to...
Yes.
Okay. I didn't lick the back of a frog. I'm just checking everyone's real.
Not
okay.
Today.
So go on. So your dog died. I'm sorry to hear that. It's
sidebar. I'm obsessed with reverse engineering a New Yorker style cartoon where the caption is, this is just for fun, two guys talking. The caption is, it's from both of us. And when you said I didn't bring a dog, it sprung to mind an option for that cartoon is a guy with a crazy looking dog. His clothes are all torn up. You know what I mean? The dog's clearly been attacking him. And then someone next to him goes, it's from both of us. That's one way to do it. I've been obsessed with this for years.
It's from both of us is very nice.
There could be a barbarian with a severed head. He's covered in blood. And there's a clean person next to him saying to the king, it's from both of us.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's very funny. But if nothing else, I'm planting it in your mind.
No, I like that.
If you ever, I like reverse caption first. I think they should do that for the New Yorker.
I think that's how
caption
all
first,
jokes are written. First. I think comedians are very much like detectives.
Yes.
Because most intelligence is about what's next.
Yes.
And we're about what just happened.
Yes.
A lot of what just happened? That seems weird.
Yes.
What just happened there?
Yes.
And kind of calling the situation as is. So we're thinking in reverse, which is kind of that thing of the detective, the classic kind of Sherlock Holmes of the, yes. Well, it must have been someone they knew because the dog didn't bark.
Right.
Noticing the dog didn't bark.
Yes.
Is an unusual thing.
Right. Or Ace Ventura with the sliding door. You said you heard him scream and then remember, do you recall?
No.
Hmm.
Saw it once, liked it.
Too busy watching The Crown, are we?
Yes, yes, I do masturbate a great deal. I quite like The Crown. A friend of mine asked the Queen if she'd seen The Crown, which was seen as being, it was a guy called David Tang, who was an extraordinary character, and he was quite good friends with the Queen, and he said, "Have you watched The Crown?" And yeah. she said, "I didn't need to. I was there."
That is very good.
Kind of good, isn't it?
But don't you think she did?
She must have.
My
surely.
Version is, did my ex-wife watch Crashing? Don't you think, after all these years, wouldn't you be curious? If my ex-wife made a TV show about our divorce, how long are you holding out?
She's got to have seen that, hasn't she?
A little bit. Maybe just the pilot?
Yeah.
And there's part of me that hopes she did, because I really tried to be respectful to her side.
I think you were, right? I think it's nice.
Maybe I did it unconsciously. There's like a baked in, like, I realize now that I was a man child. I was like a very, that's why Judd was probably drawn to it. I was like a man child, didn't know what I was doing, didn't know who I was, didn't know how to speak up.
And myself. You think that stage is over now? Oh, it's adorable. It's adorable. He thinks he's a grown man now. Look at him, dressed like a toddler.
We can't all dress like the bad guy from Toy Story 4.
It's literally the suit. Literally the suit. Yeah. I'll have you know, I was in Goosebumps.
You do have a haunted wooden puppet thing. That's the only thing I can ever get on you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Such a pleasure being here.
Let's go back to the book, because I want to know... You know, I know you were raised Catholic.
Yeah, raised Catholic. Lost my faith around 25.
And why
do you
know that?
So quite slowly, yeah. Because I lost my faith just before my mother died. And the inconvenience of it really annoyed me.
Your
like the
died.
One time that the kind
but
of sucker, the one time I needed to believe that someone had moved on. I was very enmeshed with my mother, very close to my mother in a not a dissimilar way to you.
Yeah.
And it was that thing of being able to, my question to comics is always, which of your parents was sick? There's always a sick parent.
Oh, wow.
And that we had to be the thermostat emotionally in the house.
Yes.
So we had an ability to change the mood.
That is and very well put.
You say, you know, you go to therapy and people say, well, you can't be responsible for anyone else's happiness. And you go, motherfucker, that's what I do for a living. 1,000 people are turning up for an hour. That's what I'm going to change their mood.
It's our wound turned pro.
Yeah.
We went pro with our wound.
We went pro with our yes, our issues.
Because I was, tell me if you relate, it was in the book a little bit, but like seeing something coming, and I'm not talking about physical violence or anything, but just something pretty unpleasant is brewing. Nobody speaks anybody else's language. And that's when you start like singing a song. I would sing songs. I would do bits.
I remember really clearly being in the kitchen with my mother, cooking something or whatever, and going, I'm going to go and watch a film. And she went, no, you can't go. I'm not doing anything.
Yeah.
She went, you're here for vibes.
You're here for vibes.
Just vibes. Vibes. You're just in the room. You make everything all right.
Like the goat in Seabiscuit's stall. You know about this?
There was Seabiscuit fucking a goat on the side.
He was fucking a goat.
Okay.
That's why he was so fast.
Wow.
Just gallons.
Just vibes.
But they'd put a goat in with Seabiscuit to calm him down or calm her down. I don't remember Seabiscuit.
I don't know how that works with horses, but I guess they look at the goat and go, well, at least I'm not a goat.
I think so too. Could be worse.
It could be worse. Could be this thing. What's this?
Who was it? I think it was Bob Saget. He used to walk around with his daughter and point to other dads and go, that could have been your dad. Isn't that funny?
I mean, he's such a funny bloke.
That could have been your dad. Just like, what a funny... way to say I was a good dad without saying it. You know what I mean? That could have been your dad. Just some weird guy yelling at a street lamp or whatever it is. That could have been him. Tell me everything, and I mean this so sincerely.
I don't know everything.
No, I'm 45. You already said it, though.
Go on.
I'm 45. And I'm still, my wife has had to tell me 1,000 times, you're not responsible for anyone else's happiness. And there's an intellectual knowing, and then there's a body knowing, and I'm waiting for the body knowing.
It's a weird one though, isn't it? It's that thing of like, I think taking responsibility for your own happiness is probably the root to that. Mm. I mean, it's very Ayn Rand. I think Ayn Rand gets given a hard time because I think a lot of people conflate happiness and pleasure. And so there's this whole thing of like the kind of a lot of the tech kind of libertarian Ayn Rand people sort of go, oh, well, it's all about your own happiness. And that just means, you know, we're doing whatever you want, whenever you want.
Yeah.
But that really doesn't kind of work long term, because what is happiness? It's like, it's not your life is perfect. Yeah. It's you're just able to deal with stuff in a very balanced way.
Yes.
Taking responsibility for that, I think it's a full-time job. So you've got no time for anyone else, which is kind of good. Because yeah. You being happy, it's better for the world. It's the analogy I would draw is it's the same as the oxygen masks on the plane. You've got to put yours on first before you can help anyone else.
Yeah.
Because when you're in, you know, we both, I mean, I watched the last special and I loved it. That thing about that time that your dad apologized to you.
Yeah.
The time machine, you're not going back anywhere because it never fucking happened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that thing of like, it really kind of stuck out to me. Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
I haven't filmed that joke yet, but I'm really glad you like it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. You must have seen me do that line.
Okay.
Because I'm nervous about that joke.
That's a great joke.
Because in that joke, I'm calling out my father for not apologizing to me ever. I'm sort of nervous.
Why are you nervous about that?
What do you mean? I hear my wife. That's my dad. Val would be
if
like.
That's your wife. Oof, you made bad choices.
To have a gold. You would have loved it. Our wedding night, gallons.
Yeah. Of course, gallons.
My wife really reminds me of my dad, and it really does it for me. Like, I'm into it. But
lots to unpack. But that thing of like not taking responsibility for other people's, other than in your career.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's literally what you do. You kind of go out there and.
Don't you see a beauty in like those nights where we go out and maybe it's a little rowdy or it's just a little off for some reason, and you go out and you do turn them. You have all these strategies that you've developed as a grown-up. Maybe you're quiet. You know what I mean? It's not about yelling or clapping your hands or flicking the light.
Who had the best? It was Ron White had the best advice.
Tell me.
If you're doing badly, slow down. If you're doing well, slow down.
That's very... very good.
Yeah, it's good for 99% of comics. Like, you just try and find your rhythm. Get into that thing of like where it sits right for you.
Seinfeld says too. He goes, remember, they haven't heard it, and that's a big one. They haven't heard it before.
Is he? Is he good?
Jerry Seinfeld.
Is he good?
Yeah, he's regarded as a
no. I can see white people. No, literally.
Sorry, he was Larry David's writing partner.
So great. But so great.
You had that.
That's very interesting, though. Remember, they haven't heard it before. That thing of like sort of embodying the material, remembering why you thought it was funny on stage.
Absolutely.
And remembering that you're sort of conducting them. I sort of use a lot more body movement than I ever used to.
Oh, can I compliment a very specific compliment?
Oh, yeah.
Jacob, when do you take your dick out? Doesn't ruin the bit. There's a bit in the new special.
Sure.
You unbutton your coat and you Mick Jagger your
hands. Yes, I definitely do.
And I was like, that's 1,000 at bats with that joke. That's me going like, one night you did it.
Yeah.
And then there it was. And I have the chills even talking about it because I get so excited.
It's often that thing that was
it's comedy
like the way that your performance is on stage and what you're doing. I always try and remind myself, though, being in an audience is a performance as well. It's all performative. So that thing of like being in a rock gig, it's much easier to see because people are doing this.
Yeah.
And if I said, oh, how are you doing? And you went, all right. He lost his mind. But everyone, 10,000 people in a stadium, it seems absolutely...
Yeah, that's...
He seems fine.
If I say the city we're in and you start clapping, we're not in a crowd, something's wrong.
That would be...
Yeah, something's off.
But it's that performance thing of like the audience are like, they don't think they're not working.
And also, so I was just talking to somebody about this. They were like, laughter is contagious. And there are all these concessions. It's like, it's true. They're laughing more... You know, laughter yoga, where you just laugh for no reason?
Yeah.
It's a little bit like that. But everyone's coming to
you're
laugh.
30 times more likely to laugh in an auditorium than watching it at home. Do watch my new Netflix special. It's very good. But the point still stands. The idea that you go, it's a very social noise. We're telling other people that we got it and we get it, and we're signaling to the people around us.
Yes.
It's that thing of like, I've got a theory about, in the UK, there's a real thing about like Christmas television and Christmas TV being great and the best shows, the Christmas specials and the...
Yeah.
And it's because people watch it together, at Christmas, and you watch TV isolated on your own the rest of the year.
Yeah.
And it's a different experience. It's like, why is it better in the movies than on a plane?
Yeah,
because you're not on headphones, just looking at the thing. It's not just the size of the screen; it's the shared experience, especially with like a comedy movie.
Yeah,
like seeing it on the Friday it comes out.
Yeah,
in a neighborhood where people are going to join in.
Yeah,
the best.
Seeing Borat in the theater.
Yes,
was like a peak experience for me.
It's so fantastic.
People were running around. they had to. They had to run around. I was like, wow, you made run around funny.
Yeah,
like we have to move.
So good.
Like gospel church.
Yeah.
It really felt like that. It's really, really cool. I wonder, what do you think? This is the only prepared question I have for you. I was curious. Well, your new special is fantastic. I love it. It's
correct.
So fun.
You're doing great.
Correct.
Yeah. Correct.
Points. It's so fantastic.
Yeah.
And when I was watching it, I was curious. I was like, how does your Britishness, your Englishmanness, inform your comedy persona, for lack of a better word? Meaning, there's so much rigor. When I watched The Crown, I was like, oh my God, boarding school and the fucking tightness of it and the properness of it. And there's something nice about it. There's good byproducts of that. But then here comes the cheekiest boy.
Yeah.
Well, doesn't it inform it that you're English?
It's an odd thing. I'm not. So
you're not English.
No, I'm very aware of who I am, but also I'm very aware of how I'm perceived. Mm. So I carry an Irish passport. I'm a first generation Irish immigrant. So my parents moved over in the early 70s. I was born in London, just outside London. But like, it's an Irish family. Everyone spoke with an Irish accent at home. Mm. It's that thing of like,
you know, I read that, but I just didn't even read it.
No, but it's like,
I was like, no.
But you can't. You become very aware as well that you're sort of. You're a story you tell yourself, but also you're reflected back in the world, like how people see you. So people imagine I went to Eton or something, some fancy local school, fancy fee-paying school.
Yeah.
No, local school.
Yeah.
Local school, didn't pay for anything, just, you know, and then managed to kind of, by hook or by crook, get a good education.
Yeah.
But it was back in the days when it was free.
Right. Isn't it interesting that we all do that to a certain extent, lean into like the hand we're dealt regarding how we look, how people perceive us.
Well, I think that's partly sort of the problem of living online, where you become totally self-authored, whereas actually sort of yourself should be what you know about yourself, and then it's kind of, it comes up against, you know, the environment, the other people that are around,
right,
and do they agree with that or not, and then you kind of change, and then it's that lovely thing of kind of in life when you find, I don't think you can beat your environment.
Yeah.
So you go to college and you go, well, I'm a different person here. I can decide to kind of rewrite the rules
a little bit.
And then getting into stand-up comedy, I remember going, oh, yo-ho-ho, a pirate's life for me. This will do.
Yeah.
It was the island of the broken toys.
Yes, yes.
It's like, oh, all the misfits have got together.
And I told you this last time we chatted, but it was John Mulaney of all people. We're checking into a hotel. They go, one of the rooms we have for you is a non-smoking queen. And this joke isn't too offensive, but I went, that's me, like that. It's hard. Okay,
liked it. That's
good. Not the clip, Joe. You can't clip that. Context. And Mulaney looks at me and he goes, you're like a embarrassing, fun dad. This is when we're in our 20s. So it's like, being a dad was so far away, but I was like, oh, that's how people see me. I'm a dorky dad. It led to all these jokes that I didn't know. Someone else had told me. My friend Josh Lieb said I looked like a youth pastor. And I was like, oh, I didn't know. I just thought I looked like me. Mulaney said I'm like a fun, dorky dad. These are my environment, not the self-author, alone, internet. This is who I am.
Yeah, who, like, you think you might be. And then that thing of like going out to the world. I think I slightly worry about it with like, there's a generation of kids that have had zero freedom in real life.
Yeah.
And so much freedom online.
Yeah.
And so obviously online's more fun. So they're living their lives
online.
And you go, well, actually they need to kind of go out and it's that thing of like, I don't know, not to get all serious, but the idea of saying people are doing things that are a proxy for the real thing. So they go, well, I'm going to go on porn sites endlessly rather than take the risk of having real sex. And I'm going to play video games rather than have a career.
Right.
because it's kind of that. It's like, if you think about video games, they're like sort of a proxy for a career. The different levels and the grades and the things people spend.
Right.
And there's a big boss at the end. I mean, it couldn't be any clearer.
Whoa,
what's going on.
Yes.
And people, you know, young men are spending thousands of hours getting expert at Vice City or skills.
And you get things. Status.
Yeah, and the status online, it works, and some people even make a living doing it. Great, but it's not really a substitute for the thing.
Right.
And it's the risk. It's the it's the idea you could get hurt, and there could be failure, and there could be rough and tumble. And
I'm going to say something that I've said a million times, but I want your response to it. It was an epiphany. I was like, oh, what you want, what you really want, is always on the other side of something you don't want. So you just said, like, porn versus risking vulnerability, trying to...
Yeah.
Attract a mate, or whatever you want to say, a mate. The sex is part of it, but then the feeling that you both have, let's say it is a love connection, that glow afterwards isn't just, I extinguished my sexual desire. You're actually like pride. Like, I took a risk. I was vulnerable and I was accepted. Like, it's this amazing...
Yeah,
love adjacent rush.
I suppose that thing of like risk and reward. Like, you can't have an easy life and a great character.
Yeah.
Never been done. So it's that thing of like, you go, and life is self-assignment. I didn't find that till quite late in life. I was like, just going down the line of least resistance. Well, I'll, you know, shall I stay on at school? Some people don't, but you go, well, look, of course I will. Shall I try and go to university? Yeah, I'll try and go to the best one. Shall I try and get a job? Yeah, I'll try and get the best paid one. Like, it was all just like the next trying. I don't know whose life I was trying to live, but I'd given it no thought, and kind of found myself in my mid-20s going, what do I do? I don't like this. What do I do next? And that self-assignment bit is, I think, terrifying if you've never had any practice at being out on your own.
Yes, risking and having it be a reward.
Like, it's a weird thing, like, you know, when you have kids or whatever, they're great sort of teachers, but that idea of going, they like rides at the fun fair, like the teacups, and then they like the little roller coaster, and then they like the Peppa Pig thing, and then they like the bigger one, and then eventually, and it's, what are they doing? Well, they're messing around with risk.
Yeah.
Slightly more risk, slightly more, slightly more, slightly more, and they're pushing it every time.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what life's like, right?
You
kind of push the, I'll take more risk and more risk, and how much, this is more like, I was thinking about this thing recently about what's the, you know, the world's very unfair, like gender lines, right? Mm. So there's more male CEOs, but then there's also more men in prison. And I think it's because of the performance enhancing drug that men take every day, which is testosterone, which is sort of risk. It's just, it's risk. That's what guys take, crazy, lunatic shots at things because the genetic makeup,
right,
their hormones.
So testosterone has a relationship to risk and decisiveness and all that.
Sure, all that. It's just that thing of like advice for, you know, young women, or certainly, you know, young women again to our industry. Like, like if you can sort of game it and go and take like a calculated risk at the right time of life, like bet on yourself. Mm. It's like, it's, you kind of game the system a little bit.
Mm. I thought you were going to say they should take testosterone, because it isn't, it's a crazy, when I see little, that was me going like, I don't want to get too gender normative, but there's something going on where I'm like, as a young man, I felt an insatiable desire to like go up and prove it. I'm very deeply competitive. I'm not saying women can't be this way, but there were a lot of us men, you know, cavemaning it up, pirating it up.
Isn't it that weird thing about like, it's about incentives? And there was a huge incentive, if we're not the sportiest guys, to be funny at school, there was a social status that we could garner from that. And hopefully that's changing. And that the funniest girl in school will be the most popular girl.
Right.
But that's going to change quite slowly. You know, in our, I think it'll happen sort of here first, because you've got like, there's funny girls out there doing specials, and they'll be the beacon that someone looks to and goes, right, I'm going to be a bit like Beth Stelling. I'm going to be hilarious.
And there's Natasha, and then everyone's going to. Exactly.
Yeah.
Murdering. I remember when I saw Natasha the first time at Caroline's, and I was like, what the fuck is happening here? And it's such an incredible thing. But you know what breaks my heart is, the advice that a lot of young girls get, either verbally or just figure it out, is how do you have a good date, is you laugh at what this fucking idiot says. You laugh at this dullard's jokes. And I've been at, you know, a restaurant next to a bad date, and this guy is a bag of walnuts.
I bet you have.
Just alone.
You mean the other? Yeah. That was a mirror, dummy. Yeah, it's a weird thing.
You know what I mean?
Not that anyone needs to take any advice from us, obviously, but it's kind of an interesting thing to talk about. Like, because you go, the kind of industry, it'd be nice if it was more.
yeah,
balance. But actually, but that incentives
babies,
thing.
Men are teddy babies. Like, it's but too... also,
we get like we get the rewards. We get the we get a social status from that. We're sort of demonstrating. He said, trying to find the words. We're manifesting verbal dexterity in order to avoid hard work. Mm. That's what we're doing.
That's true.
Yeah,
I would like to not dig. So I'm like, have you noticed? Like, yeah. I'm trying to get real clever with it. Yeah. And there, and yeah, we don't even have to get into that. So you're not British, but the British appreciation of the British identity and even the persona does seem to be informed that it's fun that a guy that's supposed to be so proper, you know, we're talking about a persona, is not, he's violating that idea. And that's part of the titillation, isn't it?
I think so. I think I probably get away with more because of I sound very plausible. And every time I walk on stage, I'm aware this could be a TED talk. People wouldn't mind.
Deeply plausible.
Yeah,
that's so, the next special.
So plausible.
Jimmy Carr. Plausible.
Yeah, plausible middle management. It's nice, but it's also nice to kind of it adds an element of surprise.
Yeah,
which is always kind of, it's the thing of you go, it's all about context and who's saying it on stage.
Yes.
Kind of matters. And yes. It's,
I really like the joke about, I'm sorry. I think it's a standout joke and moment of the special.
It's fun. It's a really fun bit to do as well. Like that thing of going, not to complain about cancel culture, because you sort of go, well, I mean, you can criticize it all you want.
Yeah.
Just don't call for me to be, but I didn't like it, so no one can see it.
Right, right.
That's a different thing.
Right. Right, right, right. It's also interesting. A lot of people have been making the point no one is really being canceled. Like some people are, but like Louis selling out Madison Square Garden, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah. Who's been canceled? Like it's...
Well, also, Chappelle has been canceled, the biggest selling comic in the world. Right. I was canceled. You go, I'm playing 45 countries. It seems fine.
Right.
But it's a weird thing where you go, if you looked on, I think the papers would like us to believe, or the news media, that Twitter or X is the same as the news media, is the same as the general public.
Right.
And they're all very different.
Yes.
You're in an increasingly fractured media landscape. You have your audience. And right. I remember Bill Burr saying, someone got canceled, and he was sort of saying, what are they going to do to me? Take my garage away?
Yeah.
I do the podcast in the garage.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a fancy studio like this. He doesn't have all this.
This is pretty fancy now.
Oh, yeah.
Adam Driver on. It was nice. Looks like a real... Wow. Real place.
It really feels like he's hit rock bottom. Is he okay?
I'm curious, like, what?
I mean, I'm here, but Adam Driver, Christ. Christ, you just would have thought self-respect would have prevented it. Man, doesn't matter. It's fine, I suppose.
You're not doing bills when you're in town then?
No.
How much of it? How much are you into the thrill? Because there is a thrill to doing a cheeky joke. Does it blow your hair back?
Yeah, it's my sense of humor. I mean, yeah. I think that's that thing. I often quote, actually, my friend Robbie Williams said this thing. He said, I'm an entertainer. He's a singer, right, from the UK. Yeah. He said, I'm an entertainer in the classic sense. If you don't like me, I don't like me.
Mm.
And I think comedians, we are show business adjacent, right? So we're entertainers, but we want to be liked for us. So it's that thing where you go, well, this is my sense of humor. I think this is funny. I present it to you. Obviously, the audience are sort of in charge. We're in the service industry, right? If it doesn't get a laugh, I'm not saying it. I mean, I'll try it a couple of times.
Yeah.
But on the third time, if it gets nothing, I'm never saying it's that over. Again. It's done. I'll try and change it and write, and it'll be a different joke.
Right.
But that thing of going, I have to find it funny. I have to be able to go, well, I could commit to saying this 300 times.
Right. And I mean, there's almost like something shadow worky about it. I don't want to force you into a deep Jimmy Carr moment.
No, I think there's something really cathartic.
That's what I'm saying.
For the audience as well, because it's not, there's no problem with censorship in our world. The call is coming from inside the house. Mm. It's self-censorship that's kind of going on in our culture at the moment, where you have this kind of preference falsification. Well, like, opinion polls don't work anymore.
Mm.
But people know what they're meant to say.
Yes.
And then they act in a different way. And then people go, well, I'm in an office and we have HR and there's regulations about what you can and can't say. All right. And then I have teenage kids and I don't want to upset them. And I'm okay. And then they come and, you know, see a show, right. And they're school kids and they go, well, I can't say that at school. And then you say it, and it's very cathartic.
Yes.
It's like, oh, okay.
It almost reminds me of like a sci-fi story. It's like we live in a world where it's like, yes, because everyone's hitting yes and everyone's hitting no. And
yeah.
It's very like sort of 1984 or whatever. And then you go into this magical little tree place, and then you just like weep with laughter. Taking my wife to see Bill Burr, I've said this a million times, but it was an impactful moment for me. He's doing a joke that I know she disagrees with. The premise of the joke is something that I know she intellectually and, you know, just does disagree with. And she's dying laughing. Just being wicked.
But don't you like that thing of like my favorite noise, I think, in comedy is that cognitive dissonance.
Yes.
And hearing people laugh and then the sharp intake of breath. It's got to be that way around, by the way.
Yeah,
because I wrote a lot of stuff that was just the sharp intake of breath.
Yeah.
And you go, no, shocking is great. That's so easy, though, to just do the shocking, just to kind of press the button.
Yeah.
It's got to be funny enough that it overrides the, you can't say that. Because your sense of humor gets there first. It betrays you.
Yes. It happens transrationally.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're not processing it. Yeah. And then, yeah.
What have I done?
Yeah.
And then they're laughing, going, oh, no, pick a side.
Yeah. Salty sweet.
Yeah,
it really is quite magical and really, really fun.
It's nice. And I do get an incredible thrill out of doing that.
Well, isn't there something I'll speak for me. There's something lonely about having these thoughts that we know aren't us. Not to be hyper-spiritual, but your brain is just sort of...
Yeah.
And so much of that is something you inherited from your culture, from movies, from TV, wherever you got it. And there it is, just kind of churning around like change in the dryer. And then you feel so bad that some terrible thought occurs to you in line at a Starbucks. And you just thought, and then you feel shame. And then someone like Bill Burr, he did it on Crashing. He goes, who here, if your thoughts were emailed to your whole company, just your thoughts for one day, who would have a job tomorrow? And I was like, there's something that ministers to people about that. You're screaming like, I know we're all wearing pants and we're all being hello and we all go to this and we go to that.
It is very interesting because it's that thing of like, you go, okay, I do quite edgy jokes, right? And they're obviously edgy. It's edgy subject matter and all of those kind of hot button topics, right? Yeah. But there's the Overton window of what isn't acceptable in politics, right? At any given time, there's the Overton window over there. That's what you can say on the very far left. That's what you can say on the far right. And anything beyond that is kind of beyond the pale, unacceptable. I think there's also like a social, what is it okay to talk about?
Mm.
And comedy is pushing that. So you could have quite a mild comedian or someone that's very inoffensive, but actually they're talking like Sebastian Maniscalco talking about relationships or Jerry Seinfeld talking about the maddening detail of life and the stuff that doesn't make any sense. And it actually increases what people can talk about or vocalize. So I think that is quite an interesting thing of like, you don't have to just push it in terms of the edge out there. You can push it in other interesting directions or, you know, the stuff that I was with Mark Maron earlier and you go, well, he's got this emotional bandwidth where he's entirely open and honest about his life and in an incredibly sort of vulnerable way.
Yeah.
And that, again, is very influential to a generation of comics coming through. But also, I imagine his audience, it's important.
It makes me, it's why I'm doing this. Maron inspired me to be like, oh, you can just play a voicemail from your dad? You know what I mean? Like, it seems so normal now. But when I heard Mark doing it, I was shocked that someone could, like I said about that joke about my dad, I was like, what if he hears it? And then we're like, what if he hears it? Like, we can't be afraid of our truth, of our feelings.
Yeah, I think that not self-censoring thing and letting the audience decide and you know, occasionally I'll write something and go, I might leave that. I don't know if I need the heat right now. At some point, I'll need the publicity. I'll say it then.
Schedule it.
Yeah.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What is the first thing you would do if you had an extra hour in your day? Maybe go for a nap or take a jog. Maybe play Xbox. Maybe watch The Last of Us if you don't want to play The Last of Us. Something, showing up for a friend is another good example. A lot of us wish we had more time. The question is, time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you do with it? I'm going to say the best way to squeeze that special thing into your schedule is to know what is important to you and to make it a priority. And therapy can help you figure out what matters most to you so you can do more of it. That is such a great way to reframe how people might be thinking about therapy. Oh, I have to do this, talk about my problems, talk about this, talk about my mom. That's part of it. but also just learning about yourself so you can streamline your life for the maximum bang for your buck, for your life. I've gotten so much out of talk therapy. As I always say, it's greater than the sum of its parts. Getting over issues with my family, codependence, getting through rough relationships in the past, thank goodness, getting out of relationships, navigating breakups. Talk therapy is incredible, and talking to a trained professional makes a huge difference. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can even switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. So learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/weirdo today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp. HELP.com/weirdo. We're also brought to us by our friends at Magic Mind. Of course, I have it here on the... Oh, look, it's an empty box of Magic Mind. That's how much I rip through it. Magic Mind is a productivity super drink. It is incredible. I just got back from Florida. I had it in my carry-on. Drank one before every one of the four shows. Well, I usually have one and it lasts for both shows, to be honest. Because it is about 4 hours, 5 hours of dialed-in focus in a bottle. It's a productivity drink. It's like athletes have Gatorade. Now creative people have Creatorade. It's matcha, it's nootropics, and it's adaptogens, which gets you right in that perfect sweet spot. I'm stimulated by the caffeine, calmed by the adaptogens, right there in the middle, and the nootropics help you focus and create. Don't expect wired, expect dialed in. Helps fights off procrastination, brain fog, fatigue, and some ADD symptoms. 5 to 7 hours is actually what they say. 5 to 7 hours of 30% more productivity after drinking. I say 4 hours because right around there, I can fall asleep. So it doesn't keep you up. It's not jittery, but you feel at your optimum, dialed in, doing what you do, creating, going on a good date, having a good day. Sometimes I drink it when I have absolutely nothing to get done just because I love the way it makes me feel. You guys know I'm serious about it. Always giving it to the guests. Go to magicmind.co/weird and apply my discount code at checkout weird for a limited 20% off your first order. That's magicmind.co/weird. Use discount code weird at checkout for 20% off your first order. All right, everybody, back to the show.
I do think there's a lovely thing about being, you sort of go, being cancelled is like, it's all a bit traumatic and it's not nice for the people close to you, but you sort of go, it is a wonderful filter. Mm. You find out who your friends are. Mm. It's kind of great. It's a bit painful maybe at times, but it's like, oh, that's good to know.
A big great. Real moment.
Yeah, like who calls? You never forget who calls. I always think that's the lesson from it. It's like, call on the day. If someone's going through something call or you read in the press or whatever, someone's going through a divorce or a tough time, or give them a call. That can't be nice.
Right. That day, don't be embarrassed.
It's also that thing of like, I like calling people and going, I don't know what to say.
Yeah. Just being there.
It's just, but you know what the call is.
Yeah. I'm going to try this on stage. There was a friend of mine. This is how Boston is. I'm from Boston. A friend of mine, his dad got diagnosed with cancer. So I called him. I called his dad. I'd never called this guy, but he meant a lot to me growing up. He's still alive, by the way.
Right.
Growing up with him, he was just a model of a dad, like just a different kind of dad. He was very present, always asked me, remembered all these things about my life and followed up, how's comedy? Like he could really talk about comedy and really meant a lot when I'm out there open mic. Right. So I called him and I'm just like, I just want to tell you, you know, you were like another dad to me. And I didn't mention the cancer. I was just like, I just love you. I really love you. And I hope you're doing okay. Just wanted to check in. It was on Father's Day.
Right.
A couple days later, his son calls me and goes, my father says you're having a midlife crisis or something. Why, you queer? I was like, fuck Boston, man. Fuck Boston. I can't. I love a lot of parts of Boston, but that specific, like, why is it California to call somebody who is ill and say, I love you? It was so Boston.
Okay, so in the comments now, we can vote on whether this is a midlife crisis or just an LA thing. My vote, midlife crisis.
People in Boston.
I called a friend's dad. What are you, queer?
Exactly. You want to hear another bit I got?
I'm very, very, very this. Boston. Yeah, go on.
How excited was Boston when queer became the appropriate term? That's like a national holiday in Boston. They never stopped with queer. What are you, queer? And now they're correct?
I guess if you stick at it long enough.
Just keep going. Just keep ringing the bell.
Wow.
And people are like, yes, I am queer. Thank you. Thank you very much. He's like, this queer likes that I called him a queer. They are fucking over the moon.
I feel seen.
Thank you. I feel seen.
I'm moving to Boston. I feel seen.
It gets
worse. I'm leaving San Francisco. They keep on calling me gay. I'm going to Boston where people respect what I'm about.
Where people get it.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you for these tags. I'm taking them.
Yeah. Wow. That's great.
What are you, queer? I did it in the wrong order because first you establish queer and then you tell the dad story and then you call back, what are you, queer? You get
okay.
it.
Okay.
You get it.
It's very good.
We just like jokes. Are you doing a set tonight?
No, I've got the night off. I did two last night in Sacramento, which I very much liked.
Oh, really?
So I'm trying to sort of do more in the States. I'm trying to kind of not break America, it seems.
Yeah.
It seems like you're doing a perfectly reasonable job of that on your own. but I'm sort of traveling around trying to do more cities, and I'm loving it. I really love it. Yeah. I said this a while ago, and I do stand by it. America is objectively fantastic and subjectively the worst place in the world. People think they're having a terrible time. You go, have you been to other places?
Yeah.
Because... everyone in India thinks they're doing great. I did gigs in India in January, and everyone thinks they're doing great there.
Yeah.
And you go look around, and you go, okay, I don't know where to begin. And America, it's like, oh, things are awful here. We've never been more divided. Honestly, come and look at India. Come and look at this.
Shane Gillis has that bit on his new special where he's like, you go to other places and you're like, this is your mall? He's like, this is where you shop. It was like very, very funny. I'm glad. So you're not trying to become US famous. You're trying to become real famous.
Yeah. This is where it began. But it's that thing where you go, actually, I am sort of trying to do more here because I'm really enjoying it. I love spending time here. And it feels like, you know, I spent a lot of time in New York and LA over the years just kind of messing around. I can't be bothered with any more meetings. Yeah. I'm not trying to be quite stoic. I like being stand-up.
Yeah.
And that's enough.
Yeah.
And you go, stop auditioning for jobs you don't want. And it takes a while in show business to go, there's so many distractions.
Yeah.
There's so many other things you could be doing. And it's that thing of, my friend George Mack came up with this thing recently, which I loved. He said, happiness is your standard of living minus envy.
Wow.
Went, oh, wow. That's a mic drop. That's so good, isn't it? Because you kind of go, oh yeah, the superpower is not caring what they're doing.
Yeah.
I'm just going, yeah, I'm doing my thing. It's fine.
Compare and despair.
Yes, it's
absolutely how we're wired.
Yeah.
My friend Douglas Tsoi, T-S-O-I, he has this great question. He's a financial advisor, and his big question for all his clients is,
where's my money? Where's my money? God damn it, where's the money? Shit, where'd I put the money? No. I've got a key drive. I think it's got some bitcoins on it.
I
shit.
Know this is weird, but do you know where your money is? That's what he's always asking his clients. Sorry to bother. He says, how much is enough? And I think about it all the time.
Oh, it's my favorite. One of my favorite stories is the Joseph Heller and Kurt Vonnegut story.
I don't know it.
Okay. So, Kurt Vonnegut and Joseph Heller, pretty good friends, and they're living in New York and they go to a party in the Hamptons and the guy has the mansion from Wolf of Wall Street, right? So having the party, the most beautiful women, they've got Picassos and Monets on the wall. He's got the Ferraris outside. It's a lavish party. Everyone's there. It's wall to wall celebrity. It's incredible. And Kurt Vonnegut says to Joseph Heller, this guy made more money last week than you made out of Catch 22. Mm. And Joseph Heller went, yeah, but I've got something he'll never have. And Vonnegut goes, what? And he goes, enough.
Wow. Can I tell you something? So I just got back. This was the only day you could do. So I was going to take today off. I'm very happy to be here. But I just did a spiritual retreat. I did a 7-day meditation retreat.
Was it in Hawaii?
The hot yoga guy.
The hot yoga guy.
I'm trying to roast myself. That guy was a predator.
He was trying to roast you. He's trying to roast you. What's the other guy doing in here?
It wasn't with Ram Dass. Ram Dass is passed. It was with a British man named Rupert Spira.
Was he good?
He's incredible. He's absolutely.
So what was it? How long were you on the?
It was 7 days.
Right.
It was every day, very simple meditation for an hour, breakfast, meditation, lunch, talk, done. 2-hour talk. He's a non-dualist. I'm not going to tell you all about it, but here's the point.
He's a non-dualist.
A non-dualist.
For our listeners.
Yeah. A non-dualist is basically Gandhi walks into a pizza shop, make me one with everything. So that kind of cliche, a non-dualist is trying to have the experiential knowledge of absolutely nothing being separate. Only God is real. If God is infinite, you and I are apparent with the activity of consciousness having the apparent separation to learn, experiment, play, whatever we want to say. But in truth, the awareness looking out your eyes is the same awareness that's looking out my eyes. It's all one.
Yeah. It's a weird thing how, like, that level of spirituality, which I'm interested in to a degree, but not to, you know, I watch a documentary about it. I'm not going for 7 days.
Yeah.
But that thing of, like, it gets quite close to that feeling you get when you chat to a theoretical physicist.
Oh, very similar. Yes.
I remember chatting to, I went to lunch with Eric Weinstein, and I felt like a bit giddy afterwards about like, oh yeah, what happens?
Mm-hmm. That's again, remember my passion is when different fields agree with each other, I get really excited as well. So there's a lot of, here's my point though. We're in a convent. My room was.
They don't know we're there.
They don't know we're there.
The nuns don't know.
We're not going
to. We've all got convictions.
Not going to make a habit of it.
Nice.
I do well on a British chat show. Puns. Sure.
Puns are great.
I love puns.
Thing about puns, you need 3 in a row to get an applause break.
Oh.
That's the secret. Never have a pun on its
own. They seemed a little cross build. That we were there.
Of course.
But by the end, we felt like sisters. Anything?
Yeah, great.
It was fine. Perfect. That was 3.
It's 3. It's good.
All right. I'm just impressed I came up with 3. We're in a convent. My room was 1/5 the size of this. It was the size of a bed, and the bed was tiny, and it was hard. It was uncomfortable. Little flat pillow. This is my room. There's a college. There's a bathroom that we share in the hallway. Shower sometimes just turns off. By the way, the shower head came up to here on me because I'm 6'6". Turns off every once in a while. Goes scalding hot every time someone flushes the toilet. Food at this retreat, fine. You know, B minus, fine. But we're there, and we're the happiest people you would ever see anywhere in the world. This idea of happiness, we were finding community. There's huge studies for saying that, like, socialization and, like, eating.
Well, yeah,
together,
they always take the wrong together thing from those reports. They always go, oh, this is where people live to 100.
Yeah.
They always go, oh yeah, because they eat olive oil. No, dummy, it's because they eat together.
They eat olive oil together.
You're
absolutely right.
Nothing to do with the olive oil.
Heart healthy olive oil. Or could it be that they're never alone?
Yeah.
Like, they're always someone there. Addiction being tied to isolation, early death tied to isolation. They say it's
I think the opposite of addiction isn't sobriety, it's purpose.
Mm.
It always seems to be purpose. It's like, give them something to...
I completely agree. And contribution. So you were talking earlier...
Because you turned me onto that... Did you turn me onto that book? The John Sarno-inspired book about alcohol.
Oh, This Naked Mind.
Yeah.
Did you read it?
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was fantastic.
Are you off the sauce?
No, I drink a little bit, but I like... I really like it.
You don't have to stop drinking, but it's very interesting.
But it's that thing of, like, I've recommended it to so many people that don't like the 12-step thing. It didn't work for them.
Yeah.
They're not going to meetings. It's not their thing.
Yeah.
But you go, that John Sarno, the healing back pain thing was really good for me.
Yeah.
I really love that. If you've got back pain, it's like, okay, that could be, it might be a legit thing. You might have an injury from a car crash, or it might be an emotional thing that you need to work through, and then it's just going to go.
Yes.
When you know, once you get the message, you hang up the phone.
Well, let me tell you this. I started to, we did 2 today, and I started to tell this to John C. Reilly, but I didn't get to the punchline. I went in chewing Nicorette. I like nicotine. It wasn't Nicorette, but you know what I mean? Nicotine.
Type. Yeah.
I just like it. I'm kind of an addict kind of guy. It's a mood elevator, stimulant, kind of like coffee. And I went in chewing it. Day one, I'm chewing it. I just had one piece, very light for me. I usually had between six and 10 pieces. And, like, after breakfast with all these people, like-minded people, after meditation, getting a deep connection to myself.
Yeah.
Like, the source, like, not to be weird, but Jesus called it the spring. There's a spring inside you. And we can take religion out of that. There is a spring inside you. There is a self-generating...
Well, I'm a puppet from Toy Story 3.
4.
I think the callback worked.
I could have let it go.
You could have.
Should have. I'm going to add should have let it go.
Well, this is what the edit's for. This is why we rehearse.
Yeah, when we do this for real, I'll say, right you are. But what was I saying? Oh, spring, that's awareness, that's consciousness. It's a phenomenon. You can tap into it and get in touch with it. And it's very peaceful. Like the characteristics.
I've got a theory about smoking.
Let me get the punchline. Day one, I didn't do it.
Yeah.
Day seven, I was off it.
Yeah.
Because I was constantly...
Well, here's my theory about...
I was mirroring people and being mirrored, being loved, supported.
Were you? Okay. So my theory is people that like cigarettes, right, they go outside and they do a deep breathing exercise for 7 minutes, 10 times a day.
Yeah.
It's meditation.
Yeah.
There's lots of things that are meditation that we don't think of as meditation. It's like that thing of like when you're sat on the bus or the train and you kind of come to and it's your stop.
Yeah.
But there's a bit of your consciousness that was watching for your stop, but then your mind wandered off somewhere else and you're kind of meditating. Why do people like walking in
nature?
In nature, because they feel like in awe, something bigger than me, and they let their mind drift and it's just very, they're kind of in a flow state. And you go, well, actually, going and doing that breathing three times a day.
Yep.
You go, well, this might as well be smoking. It's like you're doing most of the hard work. I think most of the smoking is the taking a break, taking some time.
Yeah.
It's like a prayer ritual.
I agree. This is Tony Robbins. You also get other things out of it. You get significance because you're a bad boy.
From cigarettes?
From cigarettes.
Sure.
You get an identity. It might not be bad boy identity, but it's definitely bolstering your identity.
And you felt you needed a bad boy identity?
This
was weird.
Right. I wasn't. This was just the gum.
Yeah. Just gum was bad boy enough for you.
That's right.
Like a bad boy in Singapore.
Pete Holmes, bad boy bubblegum. Bubblegum bad boy.
Yeah.
That's my new special. But I'm more just the chemical. So I'm just getting like literally a dopamine boost. It's like pushing a button for dopamine.
Right.
So mine was just more pure, just the chemical, just addiction. But the community and also learning to invest. This is one more non-dual thing, okay? Just because I think you might like it. It's like we are... All of our experiences happening in a field of consciousness, right? This idea, it's appearing. And non-dual practice is exploring the nature of that consciousness. When who am I when you take experience away from me? If you take your sights, your sounds, your feelings, what remains? And then the second question is, what is the nature of that space? It's like removing everything from this room. If we took all the furniture out, what is just the empty room like? What is your empty awareness like? And the answer is, and I'm not just telling you this, you can do it and look for yourself. It's like peace. It's joyful. This is why those monks on those Greek islands are living so long, is they've dug a well, you know what I mean, into that space.
Yeah. I love that story in the book
there all day.
That you had about the guy, Timothy Leary and
Ramdas.
Going off to India, finding the guru, and giving them a ton of LSD.
Yes.
And the guy going, meh, fine. No, that's where I live.
That's right.
I'm there all the time.
Right.
And what's the analogy? You don't need to take
to Detroit.
When you're in Detroit.
Yeah.
It's kind of great.
Yeah, there's so much. And Richard Rohr would say, in religion, we're worshiping signposts. The sign says Detroit, 10 miles that way. So it's the Bible, it's the church, it's a person, it's a teacher. And we all gather around to worship that instead of just going to fucking Detroit.
Yeah, I thought the sports analogy was fantastic.
The run with the ball?
Yeah.
Sweet.
It's a really good...
Oh, thank you.
Do your thing. Yeah, but it struck me as very kind of forgettable.
I'm glad that you picked up on that, because that is to me what is missing from religion, is it's about you. It's about your...
I felt like that could be a bit stand-up.
Say what? Oh, the
football analogy. Like it needs something, but it's like it
Jesus.
Feels like it's got the...
Oh, okay.
This is what I took from it.
Okay. I'll look back at that.
Kind of pass me the ball and then you got to do your thing.
Right. For those of you, for the millions of you who haven't read my books, Jesus is like a football player and he's running and he gets tackled at the 10-yard line and the ball spits out, it's a fumble, and you pick it up and you're on Jesus's team. And instead of running with the ball, you just start clapping for Jesus. And it's like, you're supposed to run with the ball. Like you're supposed to keep the whole thing. Now we're talking about the meaning of the universe is moving forward. It's arcing in a direction and you are part of it. It's not just about, oh, now I'm preaching, but it's not just about like celebrating, pick your person, Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad. It's not just about that. They're avatars for us. They're symbols to transform us, because we transform from symbols, words and ideas. Me telling you consciousness, doesn't really get you there. It's like you need to fall in love with a symbol and a person and a story, but then at that point, you need to pick it up and continue the story, because it's you. Who the fuck else could it be about? It's you.
It's interesting. It's that thing of the idea of kind of grief, the idea of like going, well, I don't know about you, but like grief now to me kind of reminds me that this is it. This is like, because grief is like cumulative, right? It's all the grief. The dog dies, you're in bits because it's, you remember, oh, my mother died and my friend died and my, people close to you and you love and you miss them all. And you go, oh no, I'm going to die. I'm going to have to say goodbye at some stage. And you go, well, it's this brief shaft of light. Yeah. And everyone seems so obsessed by what happens afterwards, but no one thinks about what happened before.
Yeah. Before death.
No, before birth.
Oh yeah.
No one thinks of that end of the telescope.
Yes. It's the other side of the door.
It's a shaft of light, but the quote was Mark Twain had the quote, I wasn't alive for 8 billion years before my birth and it didn't inconvenience me in the least.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's in the book too. When I was briefly atheist, people were like, where were you before you were born? It didn't hurt and you didn't mind.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful idea, of course. If I do explain...
Isn't that the thing written on Christ's cross? The INR...
I think that's King of the... Here lies the King of the Jews, I thought.
No, it's an old Roman thing.
Really?
What's it? It means... I think it says in Latin, I was not, I was, I am not, I do not care.
No.
Yeah, it's R N A something, isn't it?
Inri, maybe Urnri.
It's an old sort of the Romans used to put it on their on their stones. That. Yeah,
my
full of something.
My fun fact is this is fully God, fully man, and the Trinity. That's what somebody told me. That's why he's doing that. I always thought in the icons he's going, I know, I'm here. Relax.
What's he saying?
Relax. Fully God, fully man. So the two states of Christ, and then this is the Trinity. That's what somebody told me.
Is he? Okay.
I thought it was, whoa.
It's not. It's definitely not some white power thing, is he? It made me do something terrible.
A new shocker.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
So where are you with that stuff? Because you sounded like you resonated with what I was trying to do, which was saying, do you think Ricky Gervais would like my joke, by the way, when I make fun of him?
Which one?
In the special, I go, it's a metaphor. I go, you really believe a talking snake gave a naked lady an apple? And I go, Jesus Christ, it's a metaphor, Ricky. I wasn't thinking that he would see it, but I was like...
Oh, you might see it.
I was just, all fair play. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're an Irishman, fair play to you. It's all in bounds. I love Ricky Gervais, but I'm just saying, can we please have a slightly more nuanced conversation? Because some people that believe or have some sort of faith structure, and tell me if this is what you related to, are looking at metaphors or looking at stories to talk about something that's quite ineffable.
Yeah. I mean, there's some people, I think we're sort of talking about all things theological. I think the big mistake was Vatican II, wasn't it? That's the big mistake, because there's a brilliant book by Ian McIlchrist about the left brain and the right brain called The Master and His Emissary. And it's the idea that we live in a world that is dominated by the left brain. Right, it's very sort of structured and it's lists, and we have this incredible ability to break things down, and that ability to break things down and see how they work is only surpassed by our ability to see the whole thing. And it's not that the left and the right brain do different things; they do the same thing but in different ways. And the emissary is the left brain, and it doesn't realize that there's a master. It doesn't realize that the right brain is seeing the whole thing. So you go, what Vatican II did is it sort of went, okay, we'll translate it into local languages and people can understand it. But that wasn't, because then it became like, it's nonsense.
Right.
The story's nonsense. It doesn't stand up. It's not real. That can't be real.
Yeah.
But when it was in Latin and there was lots of stuff being wafted around and it was just a big...
The symbols had a chance to touch
the big mystery.
Yeah.
It was just the mystery.
Right.
Just the, can you sit and go, well, I don't know.
Yes.
That's fine. If you're comfortable with that, that's fine. I'm sort of not searching for anything. I'm fine not knowing.
Yeah. And that's what it was a big, I don't know. When I was a kid, that didn't make any sense. I was like, why are they talking in Latin? They should be explaining this to us. So that didn't make any sense. But now that I'm older and I don't know room, sounds pretty great.
Yeah. It's like, it's quite nice when you go and sit in those spaces. I mean, I miss religion. I'm an atheist in that I don't believe in the fairy tales, but I see a purpose to it and I'm not particularly searching for anything. I think I found that the awe of nature or whatever in kids and sort of friendships and just being.
Yeah.
Just kind of like, I just enjoying the passage of time seems to be enough.
Yeah. Well, that's lovely. I think that's a great, you don't need my approval, but I'm giving it to you.
Thanks very much.
Do you think, have you had the experience of doing stand-up and when you watch us merge... they're feeling like there's something, for lack of a better word, something kind of magical about that. Something natural about human beings forgetting themselves and blurring.
Well, I think it's like increasingly, I think people want to go and see something live. Like they, you know, whether it's a music festival or a comedy show or something to experience that where you can be in the room with other people. And I don't know if they're consciously thinking, I want to go and do that. But I find myself as well. I want to go and see. I was in Paris a week ago. I saw Depeche Mode in Paris.
Oh, wow.
It was genuinely a spiritual thing. I mean, most of their songs are kind of religious anyway, but you go,
yeah,
the cool response of it and the whole way that he conducted it. And it was like seeing a preacher. It was like really, but it really kind of filled a hole. It was really beautiful thing to see. I was very conscious of it in the moment.
Did people keep thinking you were Billy Corgan?
I don't think I've ever had Billy Corgan.
You've never gotten Billy Corgan before?
No.
Billy Corgan with a wig?
I'll take it.
He's a bald guy.
I'll take it.
You can have it.
Billy Corgan with a wig. Smashing pumpkins.
How are the pumpkins?
They're smashing. Well, we can't call the band Terrific Pumpkins. Presumably a conversation they had at some point. Listen, we're all big fans of Gaffigan. What are we going to call the band?
Gaffigan?
Isn't Gaffigan the guy that used to... Am I getting the name right? The guy that used to smash up the watermelon.
Oh, Gallagher.
Near enough. I don't nitpick.
I'm proud that I didn't pretend to get it.
Yeah.
Will you tell me briefly about neuro-linguistic programming? Because we didn't talk about that last.
That's like, I did quite a lot of that when I was in my mid-20s, just kind of when I made that career transition. And sort of the idea of it is the map is not the territory. The idea that you've got kind of presuppositions about life.
In your mind.
So you've got like the beliefs that you don't even see. Like the fish don't see the water. You don't see that you have these beliefs about what you can do and what you can't do, but they'll absolutely dictate your life.
Mm.
And so that idea of kind of removing those and sort of it's, I suppose, you know, in its most simplistic sense, the idea of like disposition is more important than position, right? So you can try and change the world. It's very difficult. Or you could try and change how you see the world.
Yes.
And changing how you see the world and how you talk to yourself. And think of like the most important relationship you're ever going to have is kind of how you talk to yourself. And some people are so mean to themselves.
Yes.
You kind of go, wow, you like you're so compassionate to everyone else and you never cut yourself any slack.
Right. Can I tell you something? I had a vasectomy. It doesn't matter. Right? So I had a small surgical procedure and then I was at
very small. I heard. Why not? It was right there.
It was right there.
It feels like we needed
low hanging fruit.
Low-hanging fruit. Yeah. Checking into the hotel.
Ring the bell end for the... I don't know. I'm out.
All right.
So I had a little scar, and it didn't hurt at all. I was like the poster child for a vasectomy, meaning no pain, no problem. It was incredible. I go to a dinner. It's like maybe the day after, and somebody brings up this altercation I had with my dad, this story. It's kind of a funny story. But as I'm telling it, it's not funny to me. It's the story of like my dad hurting my feelings. And as I'm telling it, the punchlines are me kind of being like, and of course he says it, he doesn't even fucking know. And I'm, you know, kind of letting it out. I hadn't had any pain yet. It started really throbbing as soon as I started like allowing.
I like any story where you're at a dinner party and your cock starts throbbing. I mean, this is, it feels off brand for you, but I like it. I like where this is going.
Joe, that's not the clip.
Feels like that's the clip.
That's not the clip.
So let's get back to it. So you're at a dinner party, your cock is throbbing.
Well, I'm talking about my dad, of course.
What could make more sense?
But don't you see, like, I'm not talking about positive thinking. I'm talking about like even the story of like this time I had been hurt, had my feelings hurt, changed my biochemistry. So imagine what your own narrative, your own voice is doing, not just as like a woo-woo, the secret manifest.
Never mind
like
the woo-woo.
You're fucking yourself up.
I broke my wrist a while back on a quad bike or something silly. And they put it in a cast. You kind of go, what are we doing with this, doctor? And they don't glue it back together. There's no screw that goes into it. They just go, yeah, but we can put it in a cast and it'll fix itself.
Yeah.
That's what your body does.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
That's where medical science has got to. We'll put it in a cast, it fixes itself.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That should tell you something about like the amount of kind of what we do that's not conscious that we can sort of fix all these things.
And getting out of the way. And some of the things that are in the way are the stories we're telling about ourselves. The postscript to that story is now when I talk about my dad, it's been a life shift for me. When my dad comes up, I talk about, and people who listen to this podcast have heard me working it out, the dynamic with my family. Now I've gotten to a place, I'm going to be 45 this month. My dad comes up, I'm like, he takes over a room. He's one in a million. You know what I mean? I'm not just doing a snow job. If you want to talk about the blind spots, we can. But my default, so now when I see a text from him or whatever, it's a different association because I'm telling a different story. And either are viable choices, but I'm making a choice that is more resonant with the frequency I'm going for, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it really does make sense.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing of like going, that thing of going, at what point do you leave that stuff behind? I remember J.K. Rowling saying this amazing thing about the statute of limitations on childhood trauma. Mm. And saying, look, if you're 21 and you say I had a really rough childhood, it's like, it's pretty legitimate, right? If you're 25 and you say I'm this way, but the reason I'm being an ass is because I had a really rough childhood. So, okay. At what stage does it get ridiculous? I mean, 45?
Right.
But the answer is somewhere.
Somewhere.
At some point you kind of go, well, all of that happened, but at some stage I need to take responsibility. And that thing of like agency seems to be something that we're not, I mean, you sort of can't give people agency, but it's a weird thing, isn't it? Like someone gave me a definition recently of entitlement that I thought was really sort of useful, which was like where you are now and where you want to be. If you want to do something about that, that's ambition. If you think that's someone else's problem, that's entitlement.
Wow.
I thought it's a very clear way of seeing, because I sort of always thought of entitlement as, I don't know, maybe a problem for very wealthy people that had inherited money or something.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it seems very entitled. But you go, no, actually, it's pushing it out and saying, well, no, you've got control over this. There's nothing I can do about it.
Wow.
But you go, actually, you want people to have, that's what you want for people. You want them to have the agency to go and do something.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting to that statute of limitations for trauma. A factor is how much have you dealt with it? Because you could be 65, 75, 85, and it would be legitimate to still have it because you haven't faced it.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a call to face it. But that's exciting. That can be hard to talk about. But like, I'm one of those people that you tell me those strategies to kind of get at it. That's exciting. I like advice. Some people don't want that advice and they'll feel diminished in some way, I guess. I mean,
for some people, it's just too painful. It's just like too painful to look at, you know. Also, you know, I had some issues in childhood, but it's nothing. You read about what some people went through. You know, you read some of these biographies, you go, oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
How'd you get through that? But it seems people do.
Yeah.
Somehow. And they go, well, I'm not going to let that define me.
Right. Yeah.
And that kind of thing of, you know, trauma, it's kind of an overused word. Actually, Brennan's got a great bit in the new special about it. But that thing of like going, well, you want to kind of, you don't want it to define, like if it's only trauma if it changes the way you think about that thing forever.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just something that happened.
And so what is neurolinguistic programming? It's specifically giving yourself new ways to talk to yourself.
Yeah, new ways of like changing your language, changing your kind of, you know, changing the way that you think about things. Whether you remember things in a, what's a good example? Okay, so you can remember something in an associated or disassociated way. Okay, so if you remember something and it's through your eyes and you're in the room when you remember it and you can smell what the smells were in the kitchen and you can see who was there and you it's a very vivid memory and you get the feeling back and you're there again, right? Mm. That's a lot. It's very good for good memories. Very bad for bad memories. Mm. It's like that's what a phobia is. You're remembering it through your own eyes. You're remembering the perceived threat and you're having this experience. If you disassociate, so you imagine, okay, that thing happened. I'm remembering it, but I'm remembering myself in the corner of the room looking down and looking dispassionately. And I'm not, there's no sensory memory. I'm just looking at the thing dispassionately. Mm. It's a very distant way of looking at the world.
And this is
now one is like on the spectrum. You're not involved at all in your own life. You're kind of watching it. And one is life as opera, right? So it's saying, well, don't code every memory the same. Mm. Don't have the traumatic stuff. See from a distance. Take the lesson from it, whatever that is, and move on. And the stuff that's fantastic, enjoy it and remember it and enjoy that thing again.
Yes.
It's just a way of like going, well, why wouldn't you recode your memories? Why wouldn't you say, well, all the traumatic stuff, I'm going to remember that in black and white.
Yeah.
And you can do it. No one is making a decision about what goes on in your head and how you remember stuff.
Yes, yes.
So if you go to some hurtful school bully who was a dick
Yes.
Make them small.
Yes.
Make them further away. I mean, it sounds ridiculous in a sense.
But how our minds work is ridiculous.
It just works.
Sometimes. Yeah.
And it might not work for everyone as well. I always think that thing of it's like the different type. What a therapist should have to tell you when you first go to a therapist is, oh, you know, there's 50 different types of therapy and this one might not be for you. They should have to say that by law at the beginning of every session.
That's great.
Are you sure you want to do this therapy? Because this is Freudian. It's going to be 10 years and I'm going to tell you it's your mum. Okay, well, that sounds like a waste of time. I'm not interested in that. But what I am, you know, but cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like just literally go online and read cognitive behavioral therapy and read the thought patterns.
Yeah.
And that fixes 90% of it. Just kind of go, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's magical thinking. Oh, I'm doing magical thinking constantly.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Wow. You know what that reminds me of? Who tells you you can't think of your memories, your traumas? It's very Tony Robbins, by the way. He does that. It's like if your boss...
Tony Robbins uses a lot of NLP and he stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, that's kind of the base code for his thing.
In the morning, I do...
You just like him because he's tall.
We're the same height, I think. He's an inch taller. Anyway, in the morning, I relive my positive memories from in your body, and he's coaching you to be in your body. And then he's like, if your boss yells at you, he's like, replay it as a cartoon, replay it backwards, replay it at double speed, like just making it more and more absurd to kind of get your nervous system a little bit out of it. But what it reminds me of, like, who is policing how you think about your trauma to make yourself cope better and feel better? No one. It reminds me of, this is a real thing. If I'm reading a book, and let's say I un-earmark the page and I read one page, two pages. I'll go back and re-earmark where I earmarked it. For what? For fear that someone is going to find my book and go, he only read one page, because they'll see the
Did
old
you
earmark.
Read one page?
This is...
You're an idiot. I don't know why I'm here.
It's been real. It was you the whole time. I'm still in one of these. You may.
What is it? Water?
That has
regular water. I can't imagine it will do me any harm.
Go ahead. That has.
Allergic to cucumber and lime.
I don't think a real cucumber or a real lime went anywhere near that.
Christ, it's delicious.
Okay.
Well, let's do the ads.
We've got to do some ad reads, haven't we? It's a podcast. This is the longest.
Yeah. We've
Hello
gone
Fresh.
Without an ad. No Hello Fresh.
No Hello Fresh. Who do you advertise? Who do you?
Well, Modern Mammals. This actually is my favorite shampoo. I like off mic chat.
Your favorite
that.
Shampoo?
Yeah.
Someone's gone to you and gone,
what's
this? This is what we need to get involved with. Who have we got on line two? Gwyneth Paltrow. No. I want Pete Holmes.
Get me Holmesy.
He's got one of those little cowlicks at the front. It's delightful.
People love it. People love it. But that's a sponsor. And so is this, Magic Mind. You should drink that.
Magic Mind.
Little matcha, little nootropics, little adaptogens. Calms you down, speeds you up a little bit, and helps you think.
Yeah. If you've got 7 days free to go on a retreat, have one of these. I'm busy. I'm a working man. I can't be doing that.
This episode is brought to us by our friends at Alpha Brain and Onnit. You guys know for the past 10 years, I have been swearing by Alpha Brain. It is a nootropic, which means it's earth-grown ingredients that help you focus with memory, concentration. It is an absolute game changer. Anything that I do that involves my brain, 15 minutes beforehand, I take 2 to 3 Alpha Brain, and I absolutely, absolutely notice a difference. I keep it in the pockets of my coats. Keep it in my travel bag. I keep it in my car. I absolutely need to have it. It is my earth-grown ingredient, secret weapon that I have come to rely on for all things creative. Stand up, I take Alpha Brain. This podcast, I take Alpha Brain. Writing, anything that you need. If you're doing something that involves your brain, wouldn't you like a little bit of a boost? It's not a stimulant. It's not like caffeine. It just gives your brain the nutrition it needs to focus at its best. If you like it 1/10 as much as I do, you're going to lose your mind. Go to Onnit, onnit.com/weird. You'll get 10% off everything you see on that landing page. Onnit.com/weird. Try Alpha Brain. It is an absolute game changer. This episode is also brought to us by our friends at Modern Mammals. You guys know I'm obsessed with Modern Mammals. It's the shampoo for guys that hate shampoo, and I was a guy that hated shampoo, and my strategy to make my hair look great was to just never wash it, which worked pretty much as far as it did until my hair got disgusting, and my hairdresser was like, please wash your hair. And it's got to be clean anyway. It feels so much better when it's clean, and there's a way to have it look fantastic and be clean, and that's Modern Mammals. It's the non-shampoo shampoo that cleans your hair like shampoo, but doesn't dry your hair out like shampoo. Shampoo. It's absolutely unbelievable. You gotta try it. It's called Magic Mud. Over 40,000 guys have switched, and the reviews are off the charts. Once you use it like me, you will be hooked for life. Do yourself a favor. Get Modern Mammals, start cleaning your hair, and don't have it turn into a fluffy, dried out mess. Have it look perfect because it leaves just the right amount of natural oil that makes it controllable and stylish and amazing. I absolutely love it. Go to modernmammals.com/weird and you can get both the bar and the bottle of Modern Mammals Magic Mud for $44. modernmammals.com/weird. Back to the show.
It's a very interesting conversation. I think that thing of, like, for me, something like NLP and cognitive behavioral therapy really replaced religion in my life, almost like an addict going, well, look, I'm not going to be addicted to nothing. I'm going to be addicted to the gym or to cooking or whatever the thing is.
And NLP was your thing.
Yeah, I think it really was. Like that kind of and also they talk a lot about it, about going, look, these things aren't true. It's just a presupposition. Will your life be better if you believe this or worse?
Yeah.
And going, well, it's a very interesting way of kind of looking at it and going, well, no one really knows.
Yeah.
But let's say if this works for you, then great.
Do you know Byron Katie, the work?
No.
It's really wonderful. I can walk you through it really fast, but if it even sounds remotely interesting, I highly recommend it. If you have a negative experience, negative belief, you do a little journaling just to get to the core. Like, what is the wound saying? Like, you could say something like, my father hurt my feelings because he doesn't care about me, or he doesn't know me. That's a better one. My father doesn't even understand me. And then you do these things. You go, is that true? My father doesn't understand me. Is it true? And let's say you're angry and you go, yeah. The second question is, can you be sure that that's true? And you're like, well, you know, if you're honest, you're like, I don't know what other people understand.
And the third question is, motherfucker, gun to your head. Is it true?
What does Marcellus Wallace look like? Yeah. Is the third question.
Why are you trying to fuck him?
Does he look like a bitch? Is the fourth question. Why are you trying to fuck him? Say what again is the turnaround? And then you shoot. Then you shoot the person.
Yeah, it's a wonderful piece of
Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
The third question is, how does it make you feel when you believe that it's true? And this is really important because you do an inventory. You go, I feel lonely. I feel sad. I feel misunderstood. I feel neglected. I feel sad. I feel angry. How would you feel if you didn't believe it? This is all, she's not a neuroscientist, but it's all neuroscience. You're just exploring the possibilities. You go, well, I would feel happy. I would feel light. I would feel connected. I'd feel free. I'd feel excited about my dad. And then you turn it around. You go, meaning, let's look at the opposite. My dad does understand me. And then you list three ways that that's true. That's called the turnaround. And you go, well, he raised me. Like specific examples of when he demonstrated his understanding of me. He got me that thing for my birthday. He calls me this. We know these stories. We have these experiences, all this stuff. But as specific as you can be. And you find other ways to turn it around. Like, I don't understand my dad. You know what I mean? Then you find other beliefs, like my dad should demonstrate his understanding to me of me in a way that I consider appropriate. Is that true? Are you the arbiter of how people should demonstrate understanding? Maybe he is showing his understanding in his way. You see, you're just full of shit. The practice is full of shit.
Well, that seems very unkind. I came on this show in good faith.
Does that sound at all interesting or similar to NLP?
Yeah, no, I mean, it sounds like, yeah, it's a very, there's a kind of practice that they do where they're kind of, you kind of go outside of yourself and look at yourself.
Yeah.
And it's a very sort of similar thing of like, going, well, is that really,
yes.
Are you sure? You're feeling it's very hot. Do you try and make it colder?
Yeah. And what's the result of it? That's what I heard you say.
It's interesting, that thing of I remember someone saying to me, and I just thought it was a great line. I think often these things of like aphorisms or quotes, there's something magical about them because it's a wisdom that's lasted so long that everything around it's gone. Mm. Everything that wasn't important is burnt away and just this little thing remains. Mm. And someone just said to me, just accept the apology you're never going to get and move on. Mm. I thought, oh yeah, that's pretty good.
I love that.
That'll do.
I love that. I'm sure you've heard unforgiveness is like drinking a poison and hoping that the person you're mad at will get sick.
Yeah.
It's just killing you. It's the same thing. Well, Lily Tomlin had a great line about it too. It doesn't matter. Let me ask you this, and we'll wrap up because, you know, you're chatting with Marc Maron, now you're talking to me. Get on with your day.
Getting all this done.
You're banging it out.
Yeah, it's good.
On the Real Famous tour.
Proper famous, American famous.
Proper famous.
Yeah.
We won't know what that means. Huh?
Huh?
Hot dogs falling out of our mouth. Huh? That's us. Just admit it.
Nice.
You are always such a refreshing... I love your perspective. That's what I'll say. AI comes up, the state of the thing. Do you have a take? Do you have a feeling about
what, AI?
Where we're arcing towards? Yeah, with artificial
I'm not worried about it. It's a covers band.
It's a what?
It's a covers band.
A covers band.
Beatles aren't worried about the counterfeit Beatles, are they? Paul McCartney's not waking up in the middle of the night going, hang on, they're covering our songs. That's all AI is at the moment. It's just spitting back a ersatz kind of, okay, so it can sort of write jokes, but they're sort of pre-written jokes that it's just lifted from elsewhere.
Yeah.
It's just taken every comedy special and gone, oh, well, I can take a bit of that and a bit of that and a bit of that. So it spits back stuff and you go, oh, that I hadn't seen that one before. I'd forgotten that one. So it might seem new.
Yeah.
I had a joke about it, about how, I'm not worried. People are worried about AI taking their jobs, but I'm not. It's going to be a long time before ChatGPT can do what I do every night. And go out. Yeah. When's it going to sexually assault someone? You set that so beautifully. But that thing of going, there's the trail.
Yes.
I kind of feel the same about China. People worry about China. I go, yeah, covers band.
They're
a covers band.
Just following the trend.
Gunpowder, yes, that's a long time ago. What have they brought to the party recently?
Mm.
It's kind of straight lift. Like, oh, they've got their version of Google. They've got their version of Alibaba, which is like their equivalent of buying something on Etsy or whatever it is. Yeah. You know, they've got like their version of everything.
Yeah.
But they're not generating anything new. I think that thing of like America, for better or for worse, is this sort of powerhouse of ideas and new things. And it's exciting. And people come up with ideas and follow through with them. I think... You know, the conversation we're having is quite a sort of metaphysical, religious conversation. You go, right, artificial intelligence. Intelligence isn't that impressive. Consciousness is very impressive.
Mm.
Because there are complex problems and there are complicated problems. It's complicated to put a man on the moon. Give me complicated all day. It's just the next step. It's the left brain. It's lots and lots of things in a row. And no matter how many things in a row, we know what comes next.
Mm.
Complex, it's impossible to know. Is there a God? What happens after we die? Which sports team will win? It's complex, not complicated.
Mm.
And AI is very good at the complicated, and I think will simplify our lives, and I think it will get rid of a lot of jobs, but I think quite mundane jobs, and it'll create new jobs. Being a podcaster wasn't...
Right.
This wasn't a thing 10 years ago. Now, we can't even imagine what's going to be a job in 10 years' time.
Right.
But there's going to be other things will come along.
Right.
We'll always like, I always think of that thing of like, it's very difficult for us. We always think we're finished. Society's finished. We're done. And it always surprises us that it isn't.
Yes.
That things move on. And we look back on when they had coaches and buggies and cobbled streets in New York and go, oh, yeah, but it's finished now.
Right, right. There's a narcissism to that, isn't there?
Of course. Well, it's that thing of like, we just have a massive bias for now.
Hmm.
But I think that thing of like going, we need to be generous a little bit in terms of going, you know, both spatially and temporally about, well, actually this is, it's a process and we keep on coming up with stuff.
Yes. I think you can't underestimate, that was brilliant. It's exactly what I wanted. You're a true professional and a delight. I think you can't underestimate humans' unsatisfiability, for lack of a better word. Insatiability is the word. Meaning, we make tools, they're incredible, but we are so restless. Our zeal, like our deeply human zeal.
I wonder, did we get that from the Greeks?
Tell me.
The Greeks were terrified of being the Egyptians.
Wow.
The Egyptians built a culture, they built the pyramids, they built a life for themselves, and then they just stopped and they just rolled for 4,000 years.
Yes.
And didn't do anything. And the Greeks saw that other great culture and it had sort of memories of it. And we can't do that.
Mm.
We've got to do something. So there's something that comes from those earliest kind of days of what we would consider civilization.
Wow.
But the idea of going, we can't do that.
Yes.
We've got to build. We've got to do something new. So that going, I mean, I'm a big fan of that book, The Beginning of Infinity.
Mm. I haven't read it.
Which is about the idea that the scientific meme is this incredible tool. So The Beginning of Infinity, that he posits that there's been 100 billion people so far. There's 8 billion people alive today. There could be trillions in the future.
Mm.
If we go to another planet, it's like a dizzying idea of going, if we get off here, if we manage to let science go, take us where it will take us, the possibilities are endless.
Wow.
And it's like this beautiful sort of thought.
Mm. I heard Elon Musk talking about how the planet is perfect for leaving it. Like, he's like, I don't think it's a coincidence that everything is just right on this planet. It's unique to make it leavable. I just thought that was interesting.
I think he has slightly the wrong idea.
Tell me.
What? I think Elon Musk is... Someone is pointing at the moon and he's staring at their finger. He's trying to get us to Mars.
Yeah.
I don't think we get anywhere with conventional power. I don't think we get anywhere in a spacecraft.
Mm.
I think, I don't want to sound like a crazy hippie, but I was chatting to Eric Weinstein about this. I think it's going to be about a new physics.
Folding the paper.
Yeah, it's going to be about that. And it's like a trippy thing of going, what's power, right? Why is this an interesting idea to talk about? Well, what's power? It's not money or arms or armies. It's like splitting the atom. That's power.
Yeah.
That's changed everything. And there's been no development, as Eric keeps on saying, there's been no development in physics for 50 years.
Mm.
What's the next thing that comes along? What's going on? Someone's working on something. And all of these stories about aliens, whatever you believe, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Either they're already here and they didn't get here flying long haul,
right?
Because there's nowhere close,
right?
Or they already have this technology, or we're working on something. I think the idea that we're working on something seems pretty plausible. If I was a government, I'd be putting all of my money into physics, because physics is the thing that has paid out more than anything else over time.
Wow.
It's the thing that has delivered our whole modern world. It doesn't get the attention that it deserves.
That's really interesting. And so we're working on the technology that would become the alien technology. Like, it's us.
I presume, yeah, that we're... There's a theory that all of the alien stuff is akin to... In the Second World War, there was the D-Day landings, right? So we had this plan, land, D-Day, we're going to do this, get back in, get the Germans, right? So they couldn't let the Germans know we were coming, so there was a bullshit story that was put out there that was to distract.
Mm.
So something similar to that is going on. Could that be the case? I mean.
You mean like a snow job? Like, look at this while we're really changing the fabric of space-time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And bending time and bending space. And I mean, that would, it's very compelling. Have you heard I'm sure you have, the theory that aliens are us from the future, like checking up on us?
I mean, that thing of like, or the idea that the world was sort of seeded by aliens or whatever. Yeah. I mean, I think there is the fossil record to kind of back up
that it wasn't
how
that.
We got, well, that, you know, it's the three humiliations of man, isn't it? Are you aware of that?
No.
There's been three humiliations for man. Mm. Copernicus was the first. We thought we were at the center of the universe. We're not. We're just like, the sun is the center of our little bit, and we're not even the center of that bit. Yeah. Okay. And then Darwin, we thought we were above the animals.
Yeah.
We're same as them. We came from them. Oh, with it. Say, all right. So we're not the center of the universe, and we're just the same as animals. Okay. But at least we've got our minds. Freud. Oh, it's just the tip of the iceberg, your consciousness.
Yeah.
Everything else is going on in the subconscious.
90%.
It's that weird thing where you're the monkey on an elephant. The elephant's in charge. You think you are.
Yes. Thank you. Yes. For that image. Right. I was just reading that yesterday morning. It was like it wasn't about the three humiliations. I love that. But it was just like, can you even just take in that 90% of your behavior is unconscious? Not just subconscious, like you could find it, like it's unconscious.
Well,
like
I feel that thing about like luck. Like, sorry, it's slightly tangential to this, but please. I think it's kind of a point worth making. Like we see certain types of luck and we don't see others. So we see Barbie Oppenheimer, I think is a good example, right? So we see Barbie, luck. Oh, she's incredibly beautiful. Margot Robbie was born that way. Isn't she lucky? Mm. No one ever goes, oh, Oppenheimer. Well, he's born with an IQ of 180 and a work ethic that's entirely heritable. No one ever thinks that.
Wow.
They go, well, that wasn't luck. That was hard work. And he applied himself. That was luck. But you go, and that the weird thing of like going, I mean, maybe it's a misogynistic thing, but people can't see how good Margot Robbie is because they just see the beauty.
Right.
And they can't see the what she does.
Right.
Because it's sort of blinded by it. And then the Cillian Murphy thing. I mean, the idea that like there's so many, how many newspaper articles were written about Margot Robbie being underweight in that movie? Mm. How few were written about Cillian Murphy being underweight in that movie.
Yeah, right. Completely valid and bizarre.
So weird.
And it is just a different kind
of... And the luck, that thing of like gratitude is the mother of all virtues. Mm. How grateful are we? Mm. Like how grateful should we be? We grew up in this time, we're here, we get to be comedians, we, you know, get to do this. It's like, it's all wonderful, but we're standing on, it's like there's luck on luck that we were born in these years. That America is so blessed that it's, you know, kind of the last 70 years been incredible.
Yeah. That is, do you do gratitude? It seems like you do.
Yeah, I try. I mean, as much as I possibly can.
She just told me it's been 90 minutes.
Yeah, she's grateful this is over.
Katie's going to do a gratitude practice.
Yeah.
That we've stopped solving the world's problems.
Is it such a love? I mean, can I just say before we...
Yes,
call it.
Yes.
I'm such a big fan of the book. It was absolutely just exceptional. I really, really enjoyed it. And it felt like a bit like this. It felt like spending time with you. So it was so authentically in your voice. Mm. I just adored it. The last special as well, I thought was just superb. I loved it. I thought it was like, it was so funny. And then you earned the right to make like three brilliant points about God and spirituality and life. And it was like, yeah, absolutely. And they were funny and it was poignant and it was really beautiful. It was very inspirational to what I loved it. And I just wanted to practice gratitude and say thank you.
I didn't know that this was what I was hoping for. As it's happening, I'm like, this is exact from a comedian that I so respect and admire. And you saying it and really seeing what I was going for feels fantastic. What a gift. Thank you. Thank you. And the book, if people like my book, I'm always like, you almost can't believe it. You know, you've written books. When people like your book, it's like, it's
it feels
so
like it's
personal.
I always find that thing of like, because often like you get stopped in an airport for a photo or something and you don't,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But if someone goes, oh, I read your book, it's like, oh, right.
That's how I feel.
Oh, I feel like
and
we're friends.
Especially because you're atheist, you know, because you don't believe, you know, atheist in the way that I suppose I'm an atheist. Meaning I don't believe there's a God out there. Anyway, let's not get into that. But the fact that
we... don't believe there's a dog in here.
That's a 90-minute callback. Yeah. It means even more. So I really, really appreciate it. And the special, which is called, it's Killer?
Natural Born Killer.
Natural Born Killer, excuse me. Natural Born Killer. It will be on Netflix.
April 16th?
April 16th.
Which I think has probably already happened.
It's fantastic. I'll say this about it, a specific compliment, apart from the jacket unbuttoning, which gives me just so masterful. Love it. We'll never forget it. And how much of it is talking to somebody in the audience, and it's just like the courage of that. It's really cool to capture something real and really, you're a master. It's so funny. And it's a little bit over an hour, I think.
I think just under.
Just under.
Just under, yeah. But it feels longer.
That was actually the opposite. I was like...
I directed this one.
It was
so
over.
So everything's a moving shot.
Yeah.
So, and I edited it on the beats.
Wow.
So it felt like, and then there's
it goes down so smooth.
There's that color change as well. So every bit of the show, there's four sections to the show, and the color changes kind of subtly in the background.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, were those reshoots that you? So you did all the jokes straight, and then the 360 shot, was that a reshoot?
The 360 was. I've got this amazing Steadicam operator that just. So for one of the late shows just came on and just rotated and just was around.
And that was the take. Audience, that was the real life.
Yeah. So it was like, you know, so all of those shots are kind of one take.
And you just asked them not to pay no mind.
Yeah. The audience kind of, you know, they can see there's lights and cameras and stuff.
Yeah,
and people
kind
of like that.
But I got the feeling that Mulaney opens his with a 360. I felt like that was a pickup. Not that that makes it bad, but the fact that maybe he did it live too is really cool.
Yeah, it's if you're into directing comedy specials. Why sometimes find with comedy specials, it's like three shots on rotation.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, it's great, but I don't know who's cutting it, but it's like they're not listening to it. They've got the sound on.
I edited, we had an editor, but we went in and did our own pass because no one can do it for you. It turns out no one can do it for you. And the language of the shots and when the cut is so important.
No one can do it for you. And that's also the spiritual message of this show.
Well, that's true. No one you're supposed to pick up the ball and run with it.
Yeah.
Jimmy, thank you so much. What a pleasure. Would you say in your Irish, your famously Irish accent, keep it crispy. It's just how we end.
Keep it crispy.
Debonair.
Thank you. It was my Bond audition.
Thank you, my friend.